is a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
And somebody to love you and give you lots and lots of science knowledge joins us, as he does every Thursday. Dr. Carl is in the house. Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, and thank you for that fabulous segue.
You know I always try. You have been on a very, very fast-moving vehicle of sorts in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, the fastest train in the world in Shanghai when I was there a couple of weeks ago.
How fast?
It could go up to 420 kilometres per hour.
Oh
so when you
gosh.
See a train coming the other direction, well, this is what it was. You see, luckily I was up there with a bunch of physicists and they told me that what I should do is sit on the side next to the oncoming train, get my camera set up with my finger resting over the button and then lean my face against the glass.
Wow.
I said, why? And they said, just do it, just do it. And then as soon as you see it, take a photo. So I put my face up against the glass and then suddenly there was this bang and in front of the plane, in front of the train coming the other way, there was this pressure wave. So I pushed the glass, even though it was mounted, you know, it was in rubber, it pushed suddenly against my face. He said, make sure you're pressing hard with your bone up against the glass, the bone of your cheekbone. So suddenly there was a thump on my cheekbone and then the train went past and then there was a bit of a vacuum at the end and then the glass pulled away. So it went thump, thump on my face. And my finger had not managed to press the button. It was that fast. So my finger was just resting above the button on the camera and then suddenly, boom, and that was it. The train had gone. and we should have a very fast train network in Australia. Like people say, oh, we'll do a study. Well, the number of people every year that travel between Sydney and Canberra back to Sydney each year is 10 million.
Wow.
That is a huge number, and you don't have to do the numbers. It just that everybody knows that's enough to support a very fast train. And the run from Sydney to Melbourne on the air is in the top four in the whole world in the number of passengers carried and the number of flights, and that will easily support a very fast train. Everybody knows that, but they say, oh, well we have to do a study on this. the result will come 2 days before you have to vote for us.
Time will tell if it ever happens.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Now,
yeah.
Dr. Carl, you've also got an answer for us from last week's Science Hour.
About the fish. How come if fish have got gills to get oxygen out of the water... And how come, if there's more oxygen in the air than there is in water, how come they can't survive? So in air, the stuff we breathe is 20% oxygen, but the amount of oxygen in the water, it's just molecules dissolved in the water, is much, much lower than that. How come the fish can't survive in air? Well, they've got the gills, and the gills are like the lungs. They're folded and folded and folded, and you've got this tremendous surface area. Your lungs have a surface area of about 70 square metres, about the size of a tennis court. And fish gills have got this tremendous surface area which needs water to support their weight. They're like wet tissue paper. And once they're out of the water, the gills just sort of go blup and they just all fold on each other. And instead of this huge surface area of many, many, many square metres, you might have the surface area of a box of matches. You have bugger all. So firstly, they don't have a big surface area for gas exchange. Secondly, when you have water on the gill or any moisture, the gill immediately takes the oxygen molecules out and then puts it into the bloodstream. And hopefully the water is then moved on and replaced by more water with more oxygen. But no, you got the same old water and the oxygen slowly diffusing into it. So that's the second reason. For the air to go into the water, then from the water into the gills, it does it so slowly, you have to count on fresh water going over the gills. And in fact, even the direction is right. They've got a thing called a countercurrent transfer system where the water goes in one direction and the blood goes in the other direction. And if you do the mathematics, it increases the efficiency of the transfer of the tiny amounts of oxygen in the water into the blood of the fish. So that's why fish in general, apart from the ones that have adapted and evolved, that's why fish cannot survive for long periods out of water.
All right. Hopefully the person who was asking that question last week heard that long answer. We've got lots of questions waiting to be asked this morning. 1-300-055-36 is the number to call. Shannon's calling in from Nelson Bay this morning. Hi, Shannon.
G'day, guys.
Hi, Dr. Shannon.
Good. What's your question?
I'd like to know if a plane's flying like due north, like say they're going from Sydney to Japan, while they're in the air, obviously the Earth's rotating, So do they need to move sideways as well to land where they want to land, or does the gravity of the Earth take the plane with it?
The gravity or the inertial frame of reference of the Earth takes them with it. So to give an example of inertial frame of reference, you're on a train. The train is doing 400 kilometres per hour. You jump into the air at the front of the train. You don't end up plastered onto the back wall of the train. You just land exactly where you, you know, took off from. And yeah, in the same way, the inertial frame of reference of the rotating Earth will carry you with it. But as you're going from the equator to the pole, at the equator, you're 6,000 kilometres from the spin axis. At the pole, you're exactly on the spin axis. And so there's a thing called transfer of angular momentum, or the Coriolis effect, which doesn't really exist, it's just transfer of angular momentum, or the example of the ice skater spinning on one skate with her arms out. And as she spins with her arms out, she's going spin, 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 and she brings her arms closer to the spin axis of her body. She brings her fists until they're on her chest, and suddenly she's spinning really faster. There is a corresponding effect of that on the plane, which makes it go off course a little bit, not a lot. And so people in who fire weapons at each other, such as guns, you know, and long-range missiles off ships and so forth, that are not self-guided, they have to correct for that. So there are different correction tables for the, which the military have had for a couple of centuries, I think, so for the British Navy, whether they're in the Northern Hemisphere or the Southern Hemisphere, and they're this far from the equator or that far from the equator, they have to apply slightly different corrections if they're firing shells from their battleships, say 1 kilometre or 30 kilometres. When you, it makes a difference. It's not a huge difference, but it has to be accounted for because you will be a little bit off course.
Thanks for the call, Shannon.
No worries. Cheers.
See you later.
Thank you, Dr. Shannon.
Alex is calling in from Baxter. Hi, Alex.
Oh, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Dr. Alex. Welcome.
My question was, I saw a documentary a little while ago, and it was suggesting that meteorites or asteroids, something like that, in space, had formed ice around them, or were icy, and before the Earth had an atmosphere or anything like that, they'd collided with the Earth, and over time, that's where we got our water from. Mm. Now, my question was, how much oxygen is there available in space to create this water in the first place?
Look, the first thing is that the universe is practically all hydrogen, a little bit of helium, and yeah, everything else is just sort of what they call rounding errors. You and me, the iron in our bodies, the carbon, the oxygen, they're just rounding errors. They're microscopic, microscopic amounts. That's the first thing, just to get in the big scale. Yep. Secondly, when stars go through their normal cycle, they burn hydrogen and the helium, and they make the carbon, the oxygen, and the nitrogen. And when the star comes to the end of its cycle, it throws this into space. So that's how you get the oxygen in space. Then the oxygen and the hydrogen meet up with each other, they form, and then you get a molecule of water, which, as I say, always looks like a little boomerang. And then, yep, because it's so cold in space, if it happens to meet another molecule, they just stay stuck together by electrostatic attraction. They haven't got enough energy to move apart. So yes, there is lots of ice, not just methane ice, but literally water ice on some asteroids, on some comets, and yes, even on some meteors when they're out in space. And so there is oxygen in space, and Louis Frank, L-O-U-I-S Frank, F-R-A-N-K, from the University of Iowa, he came up with a theory. The comets were hitting the Earth, I think, 3 times every second and dumping 100 tons of water each time as they hit the Earth. And that's still a bit controversial, but yes, we are getting water from outer space coming into our atmosphere. Is it enough to have created the oceans? Maybe, probably. I'm not up on that theory, so I don't exactly know, but it's a fascinating topic. Is that what you were asking, Dr. Alex?
It's basically what I was asking. Dr. Alex, I like that. I've never been called Dr. Alex.
Well, this is so you don't feel like you're asking a stupid question, because no question is stupid. Every question leads to enlightenment. But
I tried to research on the internet, and it gave me very little, and it just sort of, it didn't really give me the information that I required. It talked about the hydrogen and the oxygen, but it still sort of didn't point in the direction of there was enough oxygen being formed to create oceans or anything like that. I thought maybe you could enlighten me.
Some people say that it did, and certainly all of the oxygen, all the water in the universe seems to, that we have access to, all the water on Earth seems to have been created between 8 and 12 billion years ago. That we haven't been making new water recently. So I would look up the field of astrobiology.
Astrobiology.
So if you go into Wikipedia and check up astrobiology and water, and then you find yourself heading down that pathway, and also look up the early Earth. If you're interested, there are many universities that do courses in this sort of stuff after hours. You know, you pay your money, you learn stuff, you come away, you have a good time.
Thanks for the call, Alex. Zan here with you, Triple J Mornings, and Dr. Carl is joining us as we talk science on this Thursday morning. And on the line we have Tom in Launceston, who was had a kind of a follow-up question. We were talking just about the fact that there's no oxygen in space just before that song. Tom, you've got a similar sort of question. Good morning.
Good morning. How are we?
Very well. What's your question?
My question basically relates to the veins. Mm-hmm. Now, they're blue due to deoxygenated blood.
Yeah.
So if you cut yourself, the blood goes red due to the oxygen in the air.
Yeah.
My wife's a Year 7 science teacher, and the question was posed to her. They're covering the heart at the moment. If you cut yourself in space and you cut a vein, do you bleed blue because of the deoxygenated blood, or do you bleed red?
I reckon you'd go blue. By the way, if you so that's my answer. My guess is that the blood, as it turned into little bubbles of froth and turned into a gas, if you're talking about the vacuum of space, it would, on its way there, be bluish in colour. But on the other issue of could you survive in space in a vacuum, yes. The thing is to blow all the air out of your lungs, because otherwise they could expand enormously and kill you. So blow the air out of your lungs, and you've probably got about 30 seconds, 10 seconds of consciousness, and then you've got another 2 minutes before you die for somebody to manhandle you into an airlock and then get you back to life again. So to answer your question, I reckon they would be bluish before they turned into froth and then just simply vanished. Anybody's got an answer, please give it to us on Twitter at drcarl.com, drcarl.com.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
Beautiful, thanks, guys.
See you later. Sam's calling in from Newcastle. Hi, Sam.
Hi, doctors. Sam. How are you going?
Good. What's your question?
My question is about nose hair waxing. It's mm-hmm. latest fad. I'm just wondering, if you do get your nose hair waxed, will that then affect your immune system because you're not getting all the little things stuck in your nose and the stuff not filtered out?
The nose hairs, I don't fully understand the purpose of the big ones except to maybe stop flies and insects. I managed to convince my little daughter, when she was 3 years old, that there was a previously undiscovered anatomical communication between the top of the skull and my nose, and the hairs that were vanishing out of my skull and coming out of my ears and nose. She actually believed that for a while. So I don't think they would have a direct effect on the immune system, number one. Number two, if you watch a video of somebody sneezing or coughing, it increases the production of immune system chemicals. I think they were interleukin-6. So if somebody is sick, rather than avoiding looking at them, you should look at them, and that will make your immune system stronger.
Wow.
So this leads to number three. If looking at somebody, just a mere act of looking at somebody, makes your immune system help resist them, then surely plucking the hairs out of your nose would do something to your immune system. I haven't got a paper on this. If somebody has, please tell us on Twitter, DOCTORKARL, hanging out for it.
We'll see if we can find an answer for you, Sam. Thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you very much.
Great,
see you later. Simon in St Kilda's got an awesome question that I want to know the answer to as well. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning, doctors. How are you going?
Very well.
Good.
Excellent. My question's in regards to what I know as your temple, the soft bit of skin just upon your eye and your cheek there.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know basically what its purpose is. I was always told when I was growing up that it's very sensitive. If you got a hit to that part of your head, you could die instantly. I don't know if that's true, and this is what I want to know.
Firstly, the temple, the name comes from the Greek temples, from the Latin temples temporalis, meaning time, because that's where you see the first marks of time on a person. Secondly, I was taught as a martial arts person in doing Jeet Kune Do to kick people on the temple because that would kill them. Not immediately, but after a time delay. Thirdly, I learned this then in medical school, and the temple bone, the bone under the temple, is the thinnest bone anywhere on the skull. And running immediately underneath that is an artery which is stuck to, which is adherent, which is glued to the bone, and it's called the middle meningeal artery. And what happens in this terrible, tragic case of what's called the lucid interval is that somebody receives a blow to the side of the head and the bone breaks and it bends inwards. It tears the middle meningeal artery open and then it springs back by natural elasticity and then joins back together again. But the artery is still leaking. There's no bruise on the skin because the skin wasn't squashed up against the bone. And so they sort of fall over unconscious, or not even unconscious, they just fall over and they get up and they feel all right. And then after about an hour, the blood has been building up in their brain and it's forcing the brain out of the skull. The only way the brain can get out of the skull is through a hole at the bottom of the skull called the foramen magnum, which is fancy Latin for big hole. The brain gets forced out through that skull, and at that point, the brain is what we call the brain stem, and it's tapered. And as it gets forced down, it gradually pushes on certain areas of the brain stem, and by a terrible coincidence, the areas that pressure gets applied to are the areas for breathing and for your heart beating. And so after about an hour, you say, oh, yeah, look, I might just have a little lie down. And everybody says, yeah, we'll just keep drinking, mate. Yeah, see you later. And then you go off to have a lie down, and then the pressure builds up, and then your heart rate slows down more, your breathing stops, and then you die. Wow. And they were doing operations for this 3,000 years ago in Peru and 800 years ago in Fiji. And this is called, is it trepanation? T-R-E-P-A-N-A-T-I-O-N. And until the mid-1850s, the survival rate for this operation, which they would do by cutting through the bone with very sharp coral or obsidian glass in Peru, and then finding the ends of the middle meningeal artery, then tying them off with spider web, which has a natural antibiotic in it. And the way they did in Fiji was that they would have the guy doing it, and then there'd be women constantly pouring salt water over it out of the ocean, running backwards and forwards. And they had a higher survival rate for this operation than they did in Europe. And in fact, this was one of the oldest operations. I think it goes back over 2,000-3,000 years, trepanation. So, yes, there's a strong measure of truth in what you said about the temple, Dr. Simon. Does that kind of answer your question?
That's absolutely, totally and utterly answered. That was a fantastic answer, Dr. Carl.
You called the right people. Thanks for the call, Simon.
Thank you, Dr. Simon.
See you later. Farmer Jim's on Jim is on the line from Canamble. Hi, Farmer Jim.
Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. Are you out on the fields today?
Yes, but we're not harvesting yet. We're still waiting for the crops to dry down enough to be able to get into it. But there's a few of us getting around harvesting, but yeah, it won't be too far away.
And what's your question for Dr. Carl today, Farmer Jim?
My question for you today is a common saying around farmers at harvest time is that the shock on a crop that's nearing maturity will actually bring the crop in quicker rather than delaying it. And I was just wondering what processes might be going in the plant to actually for that to occur. Just what might be happening there.
See, if it rains, when the crop is about to come to fruition, it will bring it on more quickly.
Yes, that's right. Like, it's a common observation and saying out in the farming community here, and I used to work as an agronomist myself, and I never was able to find an answer as to why that might actually be occurring, and I was just wondering whether you might have had an answer for that.
Yeah, my answer would have been, Farmer Jim, to go and ask an agronomist because almost certainly the plant is definitely the plant is a living thing and it's going down a certain pathway and it's got all of the nutrients it needs out of the soil and nitrogen out of the air if it's a nitrogen fixation plant. All it needs is water to keep the metabolic processes going. So if rain happens, depending on the plant, it will bring it more to fruition more quickly. And I would have gone to an agronomist, and you're telling me you're an agronomist, so and you haven't got an answer, so I'm missing something. What am I missing, Dr. Farmer Jim?
I'm not too sure. That's why I was asking the professionals here.
I'm not a professional.
Maybe someone's listening that can help us out. If they can, give us a call, 1-300-055-36, or you can tweet at Dr. Carl or text us on 1975-7555. We'll find out for you, Farmer Jim. We always do.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Just before we go to some more music, I wanted to read out a text Josh in Bendigo sent. Seriously, doctors, some of the stuff you say scares the hell out of me. Love it, but it scares me. That's what we do, Dr. Carl. 1-300-055-36, the number to buzz, so we can continue to scare you. Dr. Carl's joining us to talk science on this Thursday morning. 1-300-055-36. If you've got a question, you've got an answer that's come through on Twitter, Dr. Carl.
Love the good friends of Twitter. And somebody has tweeted twitted or tweeted or twat?
Tweeted.
Tweeted.
What have they
Mr.
said?
I've always passed the door at the University of New South Wales labelled Astrobiology Department, and I thought it was a joke. It's real. So that's one place you can try, and I think Macquarie has one, and maybe the University of Sydney. So to get the answer with regard to water coming from meteors, asteroids, and forming our oceans, they would be the experts.
Thank you for your answers. And, of course, we've got another answer coming through on the phone. We were just talking just before the break to Farmer Jim, I think it was, and he was asking about whether rain helps the crops come to harvest. Chris in North Melbourne, you've got the answer for us.
Hi, doctors. How are you going?
Good.
Hi,
what's your answer?
Look, I used to work in Broadacre with what Farmer Jim was speaking about, and now I work in horticulture with veggies. And we seem to find that plants will tend to come to maturity a lot quicker when there's a change in temperature. Now, in Broadacre, the maturity of the crops usually happen around December, November, December, when it's warm. And I don't think it's as much about the rain as it is the cool weather that usually comes with the rain.
Ah.
So when there's a change in temperature, when there's a warm day and then a cool night or vice versa, the plant seems to tend to mature a lot quicker.
Ah. So what is the role of water in the final maturation of a plant, or the days of needing water behind?
that's probably a little bit beyond my knowledge, but we seem to find that when the plants when there's a change in like a warm day and a cool night, which is usually through spring, we seem to find that plants, vegetable plants in particular, tend to mature so much more quicker.
Wow, and this is probably in their DNA.
Yeah, I honestly probably haven't looked into the actual the technical side of it as much.
The mechanism of it.
Yeah, it's just something that I've noticed over my years as well, that seems to be what everyone puts together when the plants are maturing, is it's a change in temperature. So the plants will be much better through winter when it's cold days and cold nights, or summer when it's warm days and warm nights. But during spring when it's a warm day and usually a cold night, the plants tend to want to mature a lot quicker.
Thanks so much for sharing the knowledge with us, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Chris.
Good on you. Cheers for the call.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Scotty's calling in from Murchison. Hi, Scotty.
How you going?
Good. What's your question?
First of all, I'll let you know Nuzzle Nips, Dr. Nuzzle Nips. I live in Murchison where the Murchison meteorite landed.
Ah, the one that's in Victoria.
Yeah,
and it was
got
in the
DNA
60s or 70s.
And RNA in it.
It had... I didn't know it had DNA. I thought that it was found to have various proteins. And at the time, that was thought to be an amazing discovery. And it was.
It was one out of...
But it wasn't necessarily DNA, though. They find DNA.
DNA and RNA.
Well, look, check up Murchison Meteorite on Wikipedia for the latest. But remember, the best thing about Wikipedia, a fine thing, are the references. Go to the references.
What's,
okay, look, thank
what's
you,
your
Dr.
question
Scotty?
This morning,
anyway,
Scotty?
Anyway, I want to talk about the Higgs boson.
Go on.
Well, we have things of matter. We have leptons, quarks, and bosons.
Yep.
And we have a photon, a Z boson, a W plus, and a W minus boson, a gluon.
Yep. What's your question, Scotty?
And the question?
Well, has the LHC or Large Hadron Collider found the Higgs boson?
Very, very faint hints of it, but almost certainly not. But almost certainly it will find it. And you're saying, well, what use is it? I'm saying that what it will do is give us space travel, because we do not understand this thing called mass. I have various properties. I have volume, so that if I put my foot into a bathtub full of water, the water overflows. We learned that from Archimedes. I have optical properties, so if light falls on me, some of it reflects and you can see me. I also have electrical and magnetic properties. We understand those. We do not understand the mass. And the dream is that if the Large Hadron Collider discovers the Higgs boson, which it will, I'm sure, and then we further down the line understand it, we'll be able to remove mass. What does this mean? So you build your spaceship, the size of a super tank, a quarter of a million tons. You fill it with everything you need to get into space, say to Mars. You then, using the knowledge we have from the Higgs boson, remove its mass. The only thing stopping you from getting into space is wind resistance. You push it up into space, and then once you've got it into space, then you shove it across towards Mars with little rockets. It gets there really quickly. Then you bring it down to the surface of Mars, and then blow me down, you've got yourself landed on the surface of Mars, and you've got hardly any matter involved.
It's that only is the dream. It might trip there.
But if you've got no mass, you can go any speed you like.
True.
And so that is the dream that will come from it. I'm saying this is science fiction. This is what we're hanging from. It sounds ridiculous, but remember, Albert Einstein's theory of relativity gave us GPS, which helps slightly inebriated people find a pizza on Saturday night.
Thanks for the call, Scotty.
All right, thanks. It's been 17 years.
See you later, mate.
We love you, Dr. Scotty.
Casey's calling in from Armidale today. Hi, Casey.
Hi, Casey. Welcome.
Hey, how you going?
Very well. You've got a great question. What is it?
I was just wondering, because I'm nearly about to pop at the moment. I'm nearly 9 months pregnant, and I was
you're
just
about
wondering
to undergo binary fission and turn into two people.
I'm that good.
You're that good, yeah? Okay.
I was just wondering why babies move around so much while they're in the womb, but it takes them, like, sort of technically 4 or 5 months to actually roll over and start doing stuff, but they're so active while they're in the womb.
Ah, because
why don't they continue that on?
Their weight is supported by the water. And so they only need to just give a little tiny push, an accidental spasm, and bing, they're bouncing against one side of the uterus, the other side, or, God help me, the liver, or even worse, the bladder. So suddenly, and then they press their head against your bladder and stretch their legs, and then you think, I went to the toilet 5 minutes ago, but now I've got to go again. Darn you, curse you, baby of doom. And then when they're born, they're in the same situation of very immature neuromuscular innovation. Now, the baby is born very mature so that we can get the head out through the birth canal. Other animals are born quite mature, and so as soon as a cow or horse is born, hey, an hour or two later it's sort of struggling onto its little legs and running around. But with the human, we've got to, all of the wiring and rewiring happens after birth. So the baby can still kick its legs, but it's so weak. And it's got no control.
Yeah.
So it takes about 6 months. And in my case, the first time you realise that the baby can actually roll is no longer paralysed when you hear it hit the ground when it falls off the bed. And normally you hear a double thump when the head hits first and then the baby hits later. I'm sorry.
But I'm sure that won't happen to you,
It won't happen because you'd be a better parent than I was.
Thanks so much for the call, Casey, and good luck.
Thank you, Dr. Casey. Hey.
See you later. Tim's calling in from the Gold Coast. Hi, Tim.
How are you?
Good. What's your question?
I'm just wondering, I'm on the Gold Coast, like you said, and it just seems to get dark here a lot quicker, like, say, from Melbourne, like, down southern Australia. Is a sunrise and a sunset, the duration, is there a difference between that and, say, longitude? We are in the axis of the world, sort of thing?
Yes. I've been a bit of a jet setter, so this week Brisbane, last week Armidale, a week before Shanghai. And as I've been going around, I always, whenever I go to a different city, I always try to find the tallest building in that city and then get myself some little alcoholic drinks, hopefully with bubbles in them, and then watch the sunset as the cars stream out of the city, then stop and then come back in again. And as you get closer to the equator, dusk is shrunk. So between the sun beginning to go down and then full night is really short. And at the other extreme, way towards the Arctic, Antarctic circles, it takes really, really long. And the only way to explain it is to look at a globe of the Earth and then imagine you've got a torch somewhere in a room, and then as the Earth slowly spins, you'll see that at the equator it happens quickly, but at the poles, the time between first loss of the sun and total darkness is longer. That's all I can say. It's a real thing, Dr. Casey. But
Dr. Tim, sorry.
It's a real thing, but I can't explain it without a globe of the world and a torch.
Thanks for the call, Tim.
Thank you.
Good on you, mate. Dave's calling in from Canberra. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I was just wondering, why is bird poo white? Because, like, seagulls and stuff eat fish and deep-fried chips like we do. But, you know.
I love that.
Yeah.
They eat other things, but, yeah, they probably do eat a lot of chips.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you what I do know before admitting I don't know the answer. The first thing is that the birds have a sort of a uric acid-type poo, I think. I'm not too sure. I think that's right. Number two, our feces are brown because of the breakdown products of hemoglobin.
Yeah.
So blood cells are made. They've got a life of about 120 days. They get recycled into the spleen, then into the liver. And most of the chemicals, because they're complicated to make, are recycled, but a few sneak through and make their way. I think bilirubin and biliverdin reductase are chemical names that spring to mind from ancient physiology lectures. And these chemicals leak through from the bloodstream, the spleen, the liver, the gallbladder, and then via the bile duct into the gut, and then that's why poo is brown. I'm guessing, and this is what I do not know, that they do not have an equivalent system, or they've got a different recycling system, and maybe somebody can Twitter us to give us the answer of why, and this is the question, Dr. Dave, why bird poo is white?
Yep.
All right, we'll see if we can find out for you, Dave. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Dr. Dave.
We've got time for a few more questions after this. 1-300-055-36. Dr. Carla's with us till midday. We're telling you lots of answers and hearing your questions this morning with Dr. Carl. You've got an answer about why bird poo is white, Carl.
Yes, according to Stephanie, God bless you, or the deity of your choice, bird, brackets, and reptile, close brackets, poop. Bird and reptile poop is separated into the white, which is the urate, and the darker bit, so separated. And it's not just white. Or they're just peeing.
Okay. Oh,
so they do have that hemoglobin thing, but where does the darker bit come out? Stephanie, tell us more. And then Surround 5000 has told us that with regard to the Murchison meteorite, yeah, amino acids, but no mention of DNA or RNA.
Thank you very much. Answers. Chris in Point Cook's got a question for us. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
It's about breast milk. The books say that if you're going to freeze it, that you shouldn't freeze it in glass, because the antibodies that are good for your baby break down. But glass is meant to be, as far as I know, pretty inert. So why would they break down in glass but not in plastic?
I'm astonished by that myself. I used to freeze breast milk when my wife was working, and I was staying at home for my little son, and I worked out that in the first year of his life that my wife, God bless her, generated 3 times her body weight in breast milk.
That's impressive.
180 kilograms, and it was all in glass. My worry about glass, which is a tiny, tiny one, is that glass can shatter. And that's really rare. And you can have, I think that's the only reason they have against it. I really don't know. I doubt the antibody thing. I thought that glass would have been more inert than plastics. If somebody from a breastfeeding association could tell us, I'd be very grateful. And Dr. Chris, what book did you get this from? Was it a...
It's from a very reputable book by a woman named Robin Barker called Baby Love.
Uh-huh.
And she and all of her stuff is referenced, so maybe I should just go and look up the references that she's got for it. But it didn't make sense to me at all.
It doesn't make sense to me, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong. I mean, I'm often wrong. I'm very happy if somebody can give us an answer, Twitter away. A ring on the POTS, plain old telephone system.
All right, we'll see if we can find out some more for you, Jess. Thanks for the call. I mean, sorry, Chris. We're going to Jess in Coffs Harbour. Good morning, Jess.
Hi, how are you going?
Good. What's your question?
Well, we've got our computer set up at home has some speakers, but recently we've got a couple of new neighbours and they've put up a massive aerial, and when we turn our speakers on, we can hear ruffled talking and we don't know if it's coming through their aerial or not. And it's not joined up to a radio or anything, but we can just hear you talking through the speakers, and it's a bit scary.
We live in electronic fog nowadays.
Okay.
200 years ago, the only electrical noise was the occasional spark from a thunderstorm going crack on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's electric noise coming everywhere. It seems to just go straight through our bodies in most cases. And the vast, vast, vast majority of cases doesn't seem to do us any harm. With regard to your particular problem, mm-hmm. I've heard of cases of laptop computers dying because somebody placed a mobile phone on the body of it while they were typing away.
Okay.
And I'm thinking that there's maybe some sort of interference like that. And it could be that they're transmitting from the antenna.
Yeah.
And they're just transmitting in all directions, and you've got tiny little bits of wire in your side of your computer that are acting as some sort of pickup. If somebody can give us a more exact answer on that, I'd be very grateful, but I think it's something along those lines. Now, what you can do is an experiment and ask the neighbours to do the experiment with you and say, yeah, you can switch it on now and then switch it off and then we'll see what we get and see if you can work out something.
Yeah.
It might be that you have to put a shade, like some... metallic fly screen on the wall, on the outside of the wall, between the air antenna and your computer or something. I don't know what it is, but if they're good neighbours, you should be able to work out a compromise.
Yeah, it's like two houses away. It's not even next door. It's weird.
Mm.
But the first thing is to work out if that's the problem. So just approach them. And if it turns out when they switch it off, they pull a plug out of the wall, there's nothing coming out of it, it could be that the lump of metal itself, the big antenna, is acting as a reflector.
Yeah, people don't talk to their neighbours enough these days.
No.
Thanks for the call, Jess.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jess.
James is calling in from Brisbane. Hi, James.
G'day.
Hi,
how you doing,
doctor?
Good. What's your question?
If you had two balls, one both the same size, one's a 10 kg mass and one's a 1 kg mass, and you drop them from a great height, say 10,000 foot, which one would hit the ground first?
If they have the same surface area that's hitting the atmosphere...
Yeah, like if they're exactly the same size balls, yeah.
Except one is hollow and one's not, they should hit the ground at the same time. And an experiment to show this was done on the moon, and it was done when the spacecraft Falcon, which is a bird, went to the moon, and they used a feather, and it might have been a golf ball. I don't know whether it was a Falcon feather, and they dropped the feather and the ball at the same time on the moon in zero vacuum, in zero atmosphere, 100% vacuum, and they both hit the ground at the same time. Now, why do you ask this, Dr. James?
I just got a bet on with a friend about it.
I think I'm right on this one.
If you drop 1 kg and 10 kg in Earth's atmosphere, like with gravity, terminal velocity wise.
The other thing to do is to actually make this, make up a ball of that sort, and then drop it off a tall building. And then at the bottom have the, is it the case of beer?
No, $100.
Well, that's
pretty
good.
Oh, science. Oh, the stakes are big. Look, I think I'm right. Please, Twitter, if you think that I'm wrong, please let me know.
Or text us in 1975, 7555.
Or do the POTS, the plane.
Thanks, James.
Yep. Cheers.
See you, mate. We'll see if we can find out for you. Sarah's calling in from the Blue Mountains. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there. How you going?
Great. What's your question?
My question for Dr. Carl is, I've got a five-year-old gorgeous little dingo cross dog who a year ago had 10 pups. And since then, I don't know exactly if it's been completely since then, but she's a really intelligent dog who sort of doesn't poo or wee in the house normally. But since the pups, she's been started weeing in a certain spot of one of my new rugs. And she knows she's not meant to do it. She sort of, you know, comes out with a tail between her legs knowing that she's done it. But I'm just wondering, like when we have babies and our pelvic floor muscles need work, could it be the same for dogs? And could this be why she's pissing in the house again?
It might be, but then you mentioned she's always doing it in a specific area.
Yep.
And I think that it might be some sort of, and here's a word, a phrase, nesting behaviour.
Yeah.
Humans do it of, oh, hi, Dr. Zan, we're going to have a baby. Why don't I paint the bedroom and we'll work out car. So I think it's quite reasonable with a dog that she's got a similar sort of nesting or territorial behaviour.
Okay.
And damage to the pelvic floor area, that's also possible. But I think, I'm not a small animal vet, but I think that is less likely because the head is not so big. In the case of humans, the head is so large that it just barely makes it through the birth canal. I think with dogs, they've got more of a safety margin. I think there's less damage, but I'd have to get a small animal vet to let us know. So I'm guessing there's some sort of nesting behaviour. This is my area. So she's thinking, I want this. This is my area. Oh, I'm sorry. I love you, my parent, Jess, because she sees you as a parent. I'm sorry to have to do this to you because I know I'm not supposed to, but I have to because I'm a dog and it's my babies and there's, you know, sort of territorial stuff.
Sure.
Where's an animal psychologist? Come on when you need
I'm pretty
one.
Sure that over the next week someone will get back to Dr. Carl. So listen out and we'll try and get the answer for you next week. Thanks for
all
the call, Sarah.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Because that is all the time we have for you this morning. Dr. Carl is going to join us again next Thursday. Thanks for calling. Thanks for being here, Dr. Carl.
Thank you. And by the way, with regard to the computer, an RF choke usually on the power line as close as possible to the unit might be able to get rid of the sound coming through off your computer speakers. Hi-fi store will sell it for you.
Thanks, Dr. Carl.
Thank you, Dr. Zen.